One more announcement. At the conclusion of our sessions down here, we're going to meet in the lobby. Next item on the, I was going to say menu, agenda is a panel discussion featuring four individuals from the Central New York area who are composers. They also teach and perform, but for our purposes, we're going to be hearing from them about compositions which they have had produced on CDs, and their experiences in getting these compositions out on the commercial recording area. Everyone's here now. If they would come forward, Neva Pilgrim, the moderator, and Andy and Dexter and Ann and Dan. Neva Pilgrim is a teacher of voice, a performer, a founding member of the Society for New Music here in Syracuse. And I'm going to let her introduce each of these people which she has invited to participate in this panel discussion. Neva?
Thank you very much. We don't have slides or any show and tell, but we do have colorful personalities, so I hope it'll make up for it. The light might help a little bit. I can tell you that they're all successful composers or they wouldn't be here, so I won't give you a long litany about their credentials. I'll say that Anne Silsby lives in Ithaca, was educated at Vassar, Syracuse, and got her doctorate at Cornell. Andy Wagoner, who teaches at SU, got his degrees at Eastman and Cornell. Dan Godfrey, who teaches at SU and is head of the School of Music right now, got his education at Yale in Iowa. And Dexter Morrill, who teaches at Colgate, got his degrees from Colgate, Stanford, and Cornell. So they, even though they all have lived here many years, they come from slightly different backgrounds and from many other places in the country, and I'm sure their experiences professionally have also been quite different. And even though the world of what new music recordings is, what should I say, not too well organized, we will try to organize this panel just a tad. We're going to start out by asking each of the composers to tell us why it's important to get their music recorded, how they went about getting it done, because we know that there are many different avenues to that, and the results, both personally and professionally, to having their music recorded and to hearing it in terms of their own growth, and perhaps also, if we have time, the historical relevance of having their music recorded. So we can start with Andy, if you'd like to start and tell us why it was important you got your music recorded.
I guess the main reason is that now my family, which is spread out across the country, can go into any record store and find my name in the in-store computer. And that's a source of great excitement to them and to me. Boy, that's a hard question. I guess, personally, a composer wants to hear their music recorded because a composer wants more than anything else to hear their music. And having a piece in compact disc format is it's a very elegant format, as you all know, and it's kind of a rush when you drop CD into the player and hit play and hear your music. So there's just immense personal satisfaction that helps to feed what for a composer is an insatiable ego. But on a professional level, of course, it's hard to get anywhere in the field without having your music recorded. And more these days, orchestras and conductors and ensembles are less interested in receiving cassette tapes and more interested in receiving CDs. And if they're commercially produced CDs, then so much the better. So there certainly is a tremendous professional advantage to having one's music out there. Then on a philosophical level, we live in a media-saturated society, and pop culture really calls the shots here. I think it's important for those of us who feel that our music is worth being heard to make certain that we're part of that whole digital culture and that we learn how to work within that world, and also then that we take something from that world into our music so that we don't run the risk of continuing to be seen as cultural dinosaurs by the rest of society. I'm not sure how far our efforts go in that direction, since we work with an admittedly very small market. But it's a market that's gradually getting bigger and is getting more and more visible, thanks to good distribution and a couple of labels that are doing a very good job. So I do think that's very important. The other part of the question, which I'll take on just really quickly and then pass it along, is how did I get my music recorded? Yeah, and that's, I think the answer is going to be the same probably down the panel, well, maybe not, but probably the same down the rest of the panel, and that is through an extraordinary amount of willful and assiduous effort. One orchestra piece I had recorded, I had the good fortune to be the runner-up in a competition in Europe for a label actually that's run by Americans living in Europe. And so I was able to have a work recorded for a fraction of the cost that I would have incurred here in the States. And much of that cost was borne by the CD label. So that's very unusual. But still, I had to send them a score and a recording of a live performance. And that was really just kind of dumb luck. And then I'm going actually back to Europe in the fall to work with this orchestra again and produce another CD. So that's turned out to be a nice relationship. The other recording that I have out is a result of working with Dan and with the Cassatt Quartet and putting together a proposal for CRI, which CRI accepted. And once again, we were very fortunate in that they incurred many of the production costs. We had to send them a master that was usable, and they took it from there. So I've certainly been very fortunate in this area. But nobody came looking for me, certainly. I had to get out and pound the pavement to some degree.
And isn't it true that CRI, if they didn't find the money, would cost, I think, $10,000 is the figure that I've heard quoted from people.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's a good second mortgage. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Anne?
Well, I would say most of the above. I just like, in terms of why record, I just like to add to that one of the benefits is that recordings are often played on the radio, and therefore mm-hmm. your music gets a very wide distribution, and often much wider than you realize. And I have mm-hmm. been constantly surprised by people who have heard one of my works played on the radio from all over the place. Mm-hmm. And then you realize that somehow it's out of your hands. It's getting off there. One of your children is left home and is flying on its own when it's when you hear somebody having heard your music and you didn't do anything about it. So that's one thing. And then I guess there's some kind of realization that your recordings, the ones that you've sort of watched over and supervised and talked with the performers about, are kind of a suggestion about how this piece is performed. And this is left behind after you, again, aren't directly involved in performances. People do have this one thing to turn to, and I know that performers all over the place will maybe not want to imitate a performance that they've heard on a recording, but they often refer to it as something that mm-hmm. gives a little clearer idea maybe than the score. There are always questions about a score, how you do this and how you do that, and a recording is very helpful. If you don't have a CD or if you're having a performance with people that aren't right with you now, you will often send them a tape so that they can refer to this. But a CD, of course, gets out there. So, let's see, I'm supposed to say, how did I...
Get your music recorded.
Get my music mm-hmm. performed on CD. Well, I have a couple of CDs. I have more LPs, and one of the stories about my CD is a story about an LP, and I happened to win a prize for a piano piece a long time ago. It was recorded as part of the prize, and was started to be released, and then somehow never made it to the States. And I never quite knew this went on. The talk about it over over, not centuries, but a really long time. I mean, I think this started back in around 1980. And then it was renegotiated and released just last year on CD, and to my total astonishment, because I didn't know this was happening. So I guess that's, again, one that sort of fell into my lap, but it took a long time to fall. It was, 17 or 18 years between the time it was recorded. And some of the benefits that might have been realized in getting the piece around if it had come out when it was written, or not long after it was written, were, of course, didn't happen, and who knows what will happen now. Some of the other CDs came about as a result of performers with whom I have a relationship over the years. As Neva did one of my songs, and other performers have brought about the recording. The Society for New Music did again an LP, which had many of our
of commissioned composers, you know, right?
And so I think your relationship with performers is perhaps one of the key ways in which your works get out.
Mm-hmm. Dexter? So.
I guess I wouldn't repeat many of those same thoughts, but I would say that I think recording today is absolutely essential, and I wouldn't even plan to do a piece if I didn't have a recording in mind, and I even find that the pieces that I choose to do are very often result of working on other pieces that fit into a compact disc format. I have to say that I think we are, I consider myself to be extraordinarily lucky to be alive at the end of the 20th century, because we have witnessed the absolute explosion of cheap recording equipment and wonderful loudspeakers, and these great gifts that we've received are just simply too much to behold. I mean, I was very, very fortunate to have become involved with computers and music, much as a result of my work at study at Stanford University, and I became, I think, a fairly good recording engineer, good enough, I think, and I was also fortunate to have been around when the DAT recorder reached the price of $600, and now one can buy a compact disc maker for just hundreds of dollars. And so in those ways, I feel very lucky. And Neva Pilgrim actually was one of the persons that made me head in this direction of just deciding to do my own recording. And and we collaborated on some music in the 70s, actually, and we made our recordings, and that got me really launched on a path of doing it myself. So I like to be involved with all of my recording, and I have three discs now that I'm working on various stages, and I'm really hoping to have all of my music, with probably the exception of my first symphony, in print, in recorded form by the year 2000. That's my kind of goal that I have, and I might not make it all, but I'd have most of, and I had all of it in some form or other. I mean, for composers today, the important thing is not the record company, it's just to make sure that whoever does this work, and we're all dealing with just tiny, tiny outfits, tiny labels. The important thing today is distribution, and Qualiton, Albany Records, these people that do the distribution. That's where the essential. Point. That's really critical today, and I really worry about that. I mean, maybe that we're coming to an. We may have lived through a golden age here. Would hope not, but it looks to me like. I worry a little bit about the continued distribution of material that has really no marketing value, music by the 30,000 composers that we all work with in the United States has almost no potential in the market. So it's simply staggering that it can be distributed on the scale that it is.
Yes, now Dan is the next speaker, and he is one of the four people who were given an award just Wednesday at the American Academy of Arts and Letters in New York, and he got some money to produce his next CD.
Is this working? Before I mention that, let me give you some anecdotes about my past experience with recordings. One is a very easy one, where the recording company happened to be owned by someone who published one of my pieces and decided to fund the whole thing and do it as a way of getting part of his catalog out into the world. And so that's the easy way to go. Next, on the level of labor intensiveness, is the experience that Andy Wagner and I had together. We had both been working with the Cassatt String Quartet in one capacity or another. With, you know, they'd been doing our music in one place or another for a number of years, and it was really a collective effort on the part of some of the composers and the ensemble to kind of conceive of this thing and to bring the recording company around to it. And there was a long period of back and forth where we would suggest one slate of composers and pieces, and there was a particular piece here and there where the record company didn't want to do it, and so we came back with other ideas. And then first they said they were going to make a grant application, and then they decided they were going to make their grant applications for another project, and we made one or two that didn't work out, and then they decided they were going to help us out. And it kind of went back and forth, and we finally got the whole thing put together. It was not an easy thing. It took a lot of initiative, and one of the things I learned from that is that if you're going to be a composer in the late 20th century, you kind of have to take the bull by the horns. It's unusual for, you know, deus ex machina to happen to composers. And then the third experience I've had with the compact disc recording is a hard luck story that I can laugh about now, in which, as a result of winning a competition, I had a large piece for orchestra recorded. The recording was done following a performance at Wolf Trap, and there was a lot of hoopla about the whole thing, and I was very excited. And then I learned about a month later, where the board of this orchestra, which is a National Repertory Orchestra, it's a summer festival orchestra in Colorado, learned that their president had embezzled $160,000 and hidden $46,000 in payroll taxes from the board. And so a lot of things went out the window, the first of which was the recording. That orchestra has spent the last 3 or 4 years putting itself back on track. And of course, this recording has been sitting in the can untouched ever since. The engineers were never paid, so they're refusing to release the tape or to edit it, et cetera, et cetera. If this is a project that will that I think is dead in the water. It can happen every which way. The recording I'm hoping to embark on next, it has a grant already to record one of two string quartets. There's a lot that has to happen before this thing is ever going to come to light. One is that the quartet and I have to find a label that we agree on, and that's an issue that's interesting, because this is a string quartet that is just recently gone up several notches in its professional standing. It's the Cassatt String Quartet, and they've become very successful of late, and it's important for them to have a label that is it would be helpful for them to have a label that's commensurate with their level of professional recognition. And the problem there is that it's really hard to know who to go after. There are independent labels, and there are these larger labels that work through established distributors, you know, the big time distributors, the Warner kinds of distributors who can buy a whole month of selling CDs to record chains and so on. And the kinds of distributors that composers usually work with, like Albany and littler ones, generally get shut out. To my knowledge, the only independent label that has anything like that kind of volume is Koch, and they often get shoved aside as well. And so those people who are looking for those labels that distribute through the big guys are so market oriented that they tend to just dismiss the whole idea of contemporary music off the top. And what that suggests to me is that some composer that you or I have never heard of from, let's say, Pocatello, could write what really is the genius piece of the century, that indeed, if people could hear it, would turn their ears and hearts around to concert music in a way that it hasn't been for 50 or 60 years. But it won't matter. There's less than a tiny chance that that music will ever be heard on a scale where people can embrace it on that level. And realizing that is very discouraging. But one plows ahead nonetheless. So somehow, I'm sure a lot of composers are in the same boat that I am, which is that actually one of the pieces that's going on the CD isn't written yet. Somehow commissioning money has to be found for that, or at least the cost of extracting score and parts. A record label that is going to agree to all that has to be located, that's acceptable and enthusiastic and acceptable to both the composer and the ensemble. Somehow economically viable arrangements for recording and editing have to be found. Unlike Beethoven, I and other composers in my situation are going to have to ride herd on the editor, or perhaps do the editing myself, and submit perhaps to a recording company a fully finished, ready-to-go master, which makes the whole thing an exercise in speculation. On the other hand, the grant requires that it not be a speculative enterprise, and so there's all of this juggling that has to go on. So that's
good. Well, as a performer, I always got paid something to record new music, although never as much as the engineer, but they were nice, usually nice guys, so we didn't mind too much. And then as a part of the Society for New Music, we felt that we commissioned works every year and gave them performances and always tried to give second performances, or sometimes as many as five or six performances if we had enough touring programs. But that still didn't seem like quite enough to do for our composers. So we, every so many years, put in for a grant to in order that we can pay for a recording. It was records at first and then CDs. And as a result of some of those efforts, some of our composers have gotten many other performances because people were able to hear those particular pieces and like them a lot, and it just happened to fit whatever instrumentation their group had. So I would say for that reason it's very important to record contemporary music. Another reason that I would like our panelists to address here is composers hear the music in their head, but they need performances to get it out there. Also, they need to hear, or what should I say, or discuss audiences' reaction to those pieces in order to keep growing and developing as composers. And I would like to know if any of them have had that experience with a more extended audience because of the recordings that are out there. Has it changed your style a little?
Well, that's interesting. I'll go first again, I guess. It hasn't changed my style. I think my style was changing anyway as a result of other kinds of input, although you're right, it was definitely a result of meeting different kinds of people in different venues, and that input simmering with what was already going on inside of me. I don't think it has appreciably, but I do, Anne was saying that the pieces get on the radio and people hear them and she's never sure when it's happening. And I do get letters every now and then and calls from people in Montana and elsewhere were telling me they've heard a piece on the radio, one of the pieces that was recorded. And that's always an interesting experience. That hasn't changed the way I write so much as it has changed the way I think about approaching performances. It's made me realize how important it is to make certain that the CD is as good as it can be, mm-hmm. because I won't have any control over when it's played. And so I want to be well represented.
Mm-hmm.
No, you know, strangely enough, the pieces that I have recorded right now are among my more thorny, tough, and somewhat confrontive pieces. My music for the last 10 years has been, I guess, confrontive in some different ways, but a little bit less dissonant on the surface. And so I think because the CDs are quite good, they haven't been off-putting to people.
Mm-hmm.
Usually people will go for just about anything if it's played well.
That's true.
And so it is important to have something, a document that you feel, you know, feel good about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the reactions of people to my pieces that they've heard on the radio or from some distance, I often don't know about. I mean, they write and they say they enjoyed hearing the piece, but I don't get any substantive reaction. The process of recording is one where a composer can learn a lot about the whole thing, what works in a recording, and
mm-hmm.
and working with the sound and engineers and working with the orchestra or the performing ensemble, the whole process. And mm-hmm. this may not, it's a little different when you're working for a performance, because it doesn't have to be so definitive. As you say, it really matters if you're going to record it permanently that it you know, not have errors and be really good in both in sound and in the performance. But the whole process of working with performers and recording people is very important, I think, in a composer's development. And it does change you. I mean, you start out not knowing what works, and as you get more and more experience with the performers and in all these various processes, after a while you do know a lot more about what works, and you go on learning. I mean, I still learn things. So I'm not sure that really answers
okay,
that
no,
question.
Okay, no, that's a big help.
Yeah, I would say in answer to your question, if I were doing, let's say, any kind of piece today, working with a small or single performer, set of performers, that usually would, my expectation would be to do a piece which would have its final form, its real form, is the recording. That's the goal of the composition for me. And to be concerned about those performers, in other words, to connect with a performer on the project, to do a series of hopefully a few performances, because performers really today are desperately short of venues, and so to try to connect performances with the recording, that is to say, we're going to start this project together. Our expectation is that it'll end up being a recording. And then we'll do some, and then work for a six-month period or a year or something like that with performers, and then go on to another project, and then the performers carry that on or do go on to another project. I'd like to say something. I'll say it quickly because I don't want to take all of Dan's time here. But I really think a lot about the internet today, what that means, and we're coming back into this visual battle with the media, and. Maybe we've been in a very fortunate age here with cheap recording and mass distribution and electronic distribution and information being so freely exchanged. But we've been still, as composers, in a purely acoustic world. And that's changing. It's changing because if we connect ourselves now to the internet and CD-ROM, which is the next question, if I were doing, let's say, a any kind of piece today, working with a small or single performer, set of performers, that usually would, my expectation would be to do a piece which would have its final form, its real form, is the recording. That's the goal of the composition for me. And to be concerned about those performers, in other words, to connect with a performer on the project, to do a series of hopefully a few performances, because performers really today are desperately short of venues, and so to try to connect performances with the recording, that is to say, we're going to start this project together. Our expectation is that it'll end up being a recording, and then we'll do some, and then work for a six-month period or a year or something like that with performers, and then go on to another project, and then performers carry that on or do go on to another project. I'd like to say something. I'll say it quickly because I don't want to take all Dan's time here, but I really think a lot about the internet today, what that means, and we're coming back into this visual battle with the media, and maybe we've been in a very fortunate age here with cheap recording and mass distribution and electronic distribution and information being so freely exchanged. But we've been still, as composers, in a purely acoustic world. And that's changing. It's changing because if we connect ourselves now to the internet and CD-ROM, which is the next thing we'll be working with, then we're back into visual materials again, and we can expect some loss of, well, it'll be a new kind of, it's going to be a new situation, and maybe very different, and I don't know if people will want to distribute discs that have a potential sale of 300 to 400 to 500, whether they'll want to bother to distribute them if they're in an acoustic material only in stores all across the country. I'm not sure they're going to. So I'm trying like crazy, frantically rushing towards 2000 to get my stuff done in some archival form, because we may face a very different world in a few, just a few years.
I think there are two pitfalls for me to the recording process. One is that when you put a lot of energy into recording and you have all of this this kind of urgency around making sure that if this is the only time people hear this piece, that they really hear it right. There's a lot of preoccupation with editing and with note accuracy and just the right kind of expression and all of these things together, and you end up poring over the whole editing process and the tape and everything else. And by the end of that, I get very used to a certain interpretation of the piece. The piece kind of takes on its recorded form in my ears. And so then I go to hear a live performance and am reminded that for me, the real joy is in hearing my music live. To have amidst this sort of onslaught of technology, the vibrancy of human contact as part of my art. But I'm also shocked that performers aren't going to necessarily do the piece the way I'm used to hearing it on this recording that I've labored long over and listened to again and again. And I have to go through a process of letting go and realizing that if the music has any kind of real-time vitality, it has to be open to all the whims and imperfections of real-time interpretation. And that's a very healthy but difficult process for me.
Yeah, I'd second that one.
Yeah. The other thing is that a good recording very often will lead to lots of exposure to a piece, and it's very easy to get confused about whether there's something about that piece that's special or whether there's something about the recording that's special. And what happens to me is the piece starts to get around as a result of really good recording, not necessarily on CD. I mean, I have some terrific recordings on tape. And those are the pieces that tend to get performed more, just because when people hear them, they hear something more with a more attractive surface because of the quality of the performance and the recording. And then I have to avoid the pitfall of thinking, yeah, well, if I write another piece like that, I'll be even more successful. And that, for me, is very dangerous. Because if that particular piece worked at all, it isn't because of the recording. It's because at that moment I was riding the crest of my own creative energies. And if I try to reproduce that moment, I've fallen off the backside of the wave at that point. And so getting preoccupied with one's musical past through the whole process of recording can be one that in the end has the potential for stultifying at least my creative output. And so those are issues that I struggle with. I think a lot of composers struggle with the whole question of live performance versus recording. I remember listening to a lecture when a composer was talking about a certain kind of technology and how this was going to be the wave of the future, and you know, pretty soon people are only going to be doing this and they weren't going to be doing live performances anymore, and we better get with it before it's too late. And what I've really observed is the opposite, that people have a kind of, a lot of the musicians I encounter and a lot of the audiences I encounter, because there's so much technology, have a thirst for the realness of real live performance. And I think maybe we're going to see a little bit of a wave in that direction instead of the other direction as technology begins to run our lives in some ways that maybe we don't welcome.
Actually, I think that might be, 50 years from now, the subject of such a conference as this, as to which were the closest to what the composer had in mind, because I talked about a month ago to a composer friend in Princeton who was all excited that he was getting his opera recorded. The orchestra had already done it in Europe, and then they were going to do the singers in Princeton and fit it all together. And I said, but what about tempi and intonation and things? Oh, that's all right. They can fix that with, just the dials. Well, I mean, it will be a shock to someone who hears that and then maybe goes and hears a live performance of that to see the difference in it. Personally, most recordings that I've been involved with have, there's a long take, or there'll be chopped up little takes, and then we run the piece. And actually, a couple of recordings I was involved in, there was an electrical problem, and so most of the recording session wasn't even taped. And we went back and ran it, and except for maybe one or two little places, that was what was used, and everybody seemed happiest with that because it breathed in a way that it doesn't if you're splicing, every bar or so. So that's my personal experience. Dexter alluded to the problem about how many people hear these tapes or CDs, hear these pieces. I can only say that WCNY invited the Society to do a program called Fresh Ink that we've done now 2 years on a Friday nights. And people have heard about this, and we get CDs and DAT tapes from all over the world. It's amazing. And the variety of stuff that comes in is incredible. And again, most of them do it because they know the technology or they're at a university where they have access to it. In fact, I just got a CD from someone at Cornell, and it's clear that on their doctoral concert that they make a CD for these young composers, which is very good, so that they can send out for just these reasons. They get broadcast, they get other performances, maybe even a commission from it. So I think any school who doesn't have that might rethink that. I don't know what SU does about that.
But we do that.
You do that. But the historical part of this is, look at Cowell. The publications, the recordings that he did, the distribution was puny at that time. Look at Harry Partch. I mean, his centennial is coming up. It's like
these composers get rediscovered, and then it's where do you find the materials, where do you find the recordings? And I'm sure that that is one reason all of you are involved, that someone will be able to find you in 100 years, right? Would any of you like to talk about your historic perspective?
Well, I just say I'm working on a couple of projects now that I never thought I'd get to do. One is I had a piece for four trumpets that Ed Tarr commissioned many years ago. It was, I guess, recorded by one group. But I'm doing a version with one trumpet player now, and he's playing all the parts. And I said to him, gee, this is really going to be a hard thing to do. But it's been kind of fun. And I'm working on another project with Lambert Orcus on in surround sound for a recording, and which is all about the hall. And that's what I think surround sound's about. I never did that before. It's going to be fun. It'd be a very kind of different way to work. And I've been thinking a lot about these, your idea, Dan, about something getting fixed. I've been thinking about getting, a lot of different versions of things done, and being able to do it so cheaply, that's the thing that's so much fun about it. Neva, isn't it just that it's so much fun to do this? I mean, that's the because I make a good salary at Colgate, I have lots of free time, and I'm really lucky to be able to do this. I don't need to make, how can I make any money in new music? I mean, I'm not going to make very much money doing this, so I'm very fortunate to be doing things that I really like to do, and recording is a marvelous way to, and I find performers increasingly interested in making recordings and getting involved in them. It's become, for me, a major venue, and the performers, if they were sitting here, I think they would argue for the same things that we are arguing for.
Anybody have anything else?
You mentioned historical perspective.
Yeah, I mean, what does it mean to you to have something that, when you're dead 50 years from now?
Oh. Give the guy a break.
It will happen.
Let me set my watch. I was hoping maybe for 60, but... Well... I probably shouldn't. I guess I haven't thought about that much, to tell you the truth. Perhaps I'm a poster child of postmodernism to some extent, but I actually pray God that that's not the case. But I haven't thought of the CDs themselves as documents. Mm-hmm. For me, the score and the lore surrounding successive performances of a piece that grow up amongst performers and other composers. Mm-hmm. For me, that's a richer legacy. I love recordings. I have lots of them. I listen to them at home, and I'm crazy about recordings, so I'm no Luddite. But to me, frankly, in the bigger picture, they seem rather trivial, at least in terms of the perpetuation and constant transformation of a musical culture. They're a piece, they're an important piece, but for me anyway, I've thought a lot more about the degree to which my presence will be manifest in successive live performances. I guess to some degree this recapitulates what Dan was saying. Mm-hmm. Or, we usually frame these discussions in either or terms. Are we going to have a future with live performance or a future with technology? I think obviously we're going to have a future with both. And so the interaction between a tradition represented by compact discs and a tradition represented by, or whatever format takes their place, mm-hmm. and a tradition represented by performance is what's going to be, that's where it's going to happen, is in that interface. And I have no control over that. I have no idea what's going to happen with my music, in 50 minutes, let alone 50 years. So,
yeah.
That wasn't much of an answer.
That's okay.
It was an interesting
question. Fair enough.
Turning it over.
I think your idea that there's this interplay between the performers and the technology is, I mean, that's what's going to happen. If anything happens after I'm dead, then this back and forth. I mean, you see this in the discussion that the lecture that we just heard.
Mm-hmm.
People talking about recordings that were taking place in the 40s and 50s and different interpretations and things like that. And presumably this will go on. But of course, the most authentic thing to leave is the score, just like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, given the fact that so much of what of our performances come about because of efforts that we take after we're gone, and it's probably fairly realistic to think that not much of anything is going to happen. And you can hope that maybe if you leave things in the library, maybe 100 years from now somebody will find them. But I won't be around to know whether this happens or not.
There will be a Silsby Gesellschaft.
Well, I have there's two people over there that want to leave their scores behind. Frankly, I'll leave my recordings behind because you can always extract the parts from a recording, you know, if you want to. The answer to the question is everyone in this room wants to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
They want to do something that counts for something, and however that happens for each of us is, what representation you might prefer doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the acoustical waveform is the end, and that's for me. That's you can get back into the hall. You can go back into any aspect of music making, and I would even argue into improvisation and find its way and make a representation in score or any other form that you like.
Good. Well, I think actually that's a very positive note on which to end this panel. However, we will take questions if you would like. I see Sue is indicating. Yes.
Snapshot of perhaps what your wishes for the performance would be. I'm curious, do any of you keep diaries or anything besides the score, which can be interpreted whoever, specific diaries as to know we want to do this way or something about your pieces, besides a recorded legacy music legacy? Is there...
I'm going to answer this because I have kept a diary over the years and many notes about things that I did when I was writing, and I am going to be very careful to tear them all up.
Yes. No, actually, that's a wonderful point. I mean, for instance, I've just been trying to find the lyrics of Lee Poe, the Harry Parch, which he did the chant part or the voice part. So can a female do it? Well, apparently, a female did do it, and he thought this was fine, and it's in writing that he thought that was fine. So that's nice to know. On the other hand, a composer friend of mine felt that, you know, the music he wrote 20 years ago, he didn't like at all. But then you talk to him 10 years later, and he'll think, oh, actually, that was a good piece. So you see these things, unless you keep your diary up to date, or the person doing the research reads all the way through the 30 years, you wouldn't really know what the composer was thinking. People do change their minds.
Perhaps I should say that I think editing is useful for diaries as it is for the music.
Uh-huh. check.
Quickly, kind of a very quick two-parter. What is your most characteristic recording that you have on the market now, and what would you like your most characteristic recording to be on the market? If you could have an option to have one thing recorded each of you.
Very good.
Huh.
I thought it was quick.
Well, both the pieces that I have on the market are both about 10 years old. And of the two, I think that the string quartet is probably more characteristic than the orchestra piece. The orchestra piece that'll be on the market probably a year from now is current. I mean, that's certainly representative. Actually, the piece I'd most like to have recorded, for some of the reasons that Dexter was saying, actually, just because this is a piece that I physically like a lot. I get a kick out of it when I look at it. Hasn't been premiered yet. It'll be premiered in Pittsburgh in the fall. That's a piece I hope to get recorded very soon, because I think it would be it's a snappy little number.
I don't really know how to answer this question either. I tend to like the most recent recording best. You know, it just has, you know, comes out and feels juicy, and you're still in love with the piece. And maybe for that reason, I don't know if it's the most recent, but the one that I feel about that I like the best at this point is a recording of my chamber orchestra piece that was done in Europe. And if one that I would really like to get done is a string quartet. I love writing string quartets, and I have a recent string quartet, and I'd love to get that done.
Chuck, were you asking us what recordings, commercial recordings that we listen to
are your own work?
I can't answer. I guess they're all different for me, and I tend to think a lot about the recent ones. Since I do a lot of my own recording and get involved with the editing, I get so sick of the pieces by the time that they come out that I don't listen to them at all. I mean, I just don't listen to my own music very much. And the Syracuse Symphony recording, which, you know, it's a reasonably good one. Recently, I didn't get involved. There was no editing. It was just a radio thing. And I've listened to that quite a bit because it only had one performance, and I didn't get involved in the editing. I'm not quite so sick of that piece. But.
Well, this gets to the whole idea of the signature piece. What piece would you like to be out there that represents you, so that when people listen to you, they think, ah, that's Godfrey, or that's Wagner, or whatever. Or that's Dexter Morrill. I think that's, for me, that's a perilous line of thinking. Because first of all, I don't think I've written the That's Godfrey piece yet. I'm sort of always moving towards that, and I think I've got it, and then I realize I don't have it, and the next piece maybe I get a little closer, a little farther away. And so I'm more conscious of the fact that if a piece gets recorded that I've written recently, I may be pretty excited about that, but even 5-6 years from now, I may be a little concerned that people are going to listen to that and think, oh, that's Godfrey, and not really want them to think that, and not really want to be preoccupied with what they think anyway. And so these are all thoughts that I try to avoid having.
Are there any other questions? Yes.
Do you compose on the computer? Or when you're talking about that, in other words, when you say I've composed something, does it get written down?
Well, I personally don't know what these other composers do, but I work directly into score, Leland Smith score program, which I think is the finest score printing software, and I have that right in back of my piano, and the piano's there, and I have built a keyboard. I'm a lousy piano player, but boy, can I type. And that's right in front of my keyboard, and my mouse is over here. And so I compose right into score, and it's a wonderful way to work. I wish now that I were younger, you know, that I could have more years to do this, but.
I guess I'm the opposite. I'm sitting at the keyboard most of the time, or else I'm tossing and turning at 3 a.m. obsessing over whatever it is I'm trying to get through in the piece. And when I kind of figure it out, I just sort of make some chicken scratches on the page enough to remind me of which direction I decided to go, or exactly what the harmony in a given situation was, or what the line is. And then when it's time, I put it all together in a sort of semi-legible pencil score that, because I simply haven't had time to really learn the software, goes to a copyist. And the copyist does the sort of thing that Dexter just told you about. And
I can't afford one of those copyists. He can't afford
one. No, it just, and he has gone through Finale and Score and God knows what else, and now his favorite software is Sibelius. So that time changes.
Well, we'd like to thank you all for including new music in this particular conference. And although we're not history yet, we will be, so.
We'd like to thank them for all making the trip in here and showing you what Syracuse has to offer the future of music and recorded music specifically. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Very nice. We have one last session.